These business models do have risk, but I think smart contract-based lending is the best business model on the planet. Because if the loan goes sour, there's no calling someone and trying to get the money back. It's just like we've instantly liquidated the collateral. We've given the liquidation fees to the people who are backstopping it, and we're moving on. I think about what to do with my cash. I'm like, do I want to put it in like a private credit fund that has like a 3-year lock and a who knows what they're investing in, backed by what collateral? And I guess they'll call me if something goes wrong. Like, fuck that.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the Wormhole Foundation. If you are a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That's why we are super pumped to have partnered with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. The Wormhole Protocol connects over 30 blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Solana, Sui, Ethereum, Layer 2s, and more. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. You can claim that by just going down into the show notes and clicking on the link. All right, guys, on with the show. Hey everyone, the liquid restaking ecosystem in Ethereum is heating up, and we're excited to announce that Swell has launched its own layer 2. This brings enhanced scalability and lower fees to liquid restaking on Swell. Very exciting because we got pre-deposits that are opening up with mainnet expecting to launch in the second half of this year. So click the link at the bottom of this episode and you're going to be hearing more about Swell later in the program. Thanks, guys. Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, if you are a listener of Bell Curve, you know that MEV is a massive problem, which is why we are so pumped to partner up with Flood on this season. Flood is the only gasless and MEV-free aggregator that not only gets you the best execution, but also gives you back all the extra surplus that you create every single time you swap. Now, this is relevant for both swappers and developers, but you're going to be hearing all about them later in the program. So for now, thank you, Flood, and back to the show.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another roundup edition of Bell Curve. You got Michael's 1 and 2 in Vance. Fellas, how we doing?
Top of the morning.
Wow. Top of the morning. We're up early for Mike.
Still a little jet lagged from London?
Dude, I got back. We got back Thursday night, and I thought I had saved it Thursday. I went to bed as late as I could, woke up the next day, felt okay. Friday, my Whoop, my like basically Fitbit, reported a total of 58 minutes of sleep.
Yeah, that's why I deleted my Whoop. Kept telling me things here.
Dude, so Yano loves these things. Yano's got like, he's got the Aura. He's had like 3 versions of the Aura before the Aura. And I'm always like, why do you want to know? Like, what's that going to tell you? That it's just going to tell me I'm not sleeping well. I know I'm not sleeping well.
I know this.
I'm on the Yano case. I'm giving that data.
Yeah. But I think going from Europe to the US is better than the other way around, at least. I always die when I go to Europe for the first, like, I struggle with that. I mean, did you guys take a red eye on your way over? I always like struggle to sleep overnight on those planes.
Pretty hard not to take a red eye flying to Europe.
Yeah,
especially from the West Coast. Yeah, it's much more difficult. But you guys want to do a quick little recap of? I mean, we were at DAS. We did Monday through Wednesday there. You guys both spoke. Lots of crypto folks on panels. Lots of like the BlackRocks and JP Morgans and the Goldmans of the world. I don't know. I mean, I had some, it was nice. It's always nice to hear. I feel like we spend a lot of our time like kind of in the weeds, like especially you guys spend most of your time talking to entrepreneurs and are kind of on the cutting edge, but it's nice, at least for me, to like kind of zoom out and hear like what BlackRock and Franklin Templeton and all these people are sort of thinking about. And I don't know, like, we've been hosting DAS. This is the 8th time we've done it. Like the institutional world moves much more slowly than the crypto world. But for me, it was at least sort of comforting to hear that like if you listen to like the BlackRocks of the world, they're in it to win it, and they are not stopping at the Bitcoin ETFs. Like, that's just the gateway drug for them. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about this sort of money market like fund that they just launched, Biddle, you know, and some of the early traction there. But that tokenization stuff feels like it's going to be real the first time.
So. And Larry's comments on Fox Business yesterday. I mean, my takeaway, one of my takeaways from DAS is that in a good way. I think we felt out of place, given that we left our suits at home. But yeah, you know, the institutions are not coming; they're here. That was one of my big takeaways. I think you had a lot of people very excited about this. You have multi strategies. You know, you got the likes of like Brevin Howard on stage with someone like us. Very, you know, somewhat different strategies in certain ways in terms of how they invest, the size that they invest, but just the fact that they're, you know, coming into the fold in size is a huge testament to where we are as an industry. The BlackRock perspective, I also thought Matt Hogan from Bitwise had some really interesting perspectives on, you know, where we are in the life cycle of the ETFs. First off, you know, the most successful ETF launch in the history of ETFs. And to your point, Mike, this is just the start. And Larry Fink yesterday on Fox Business corroborated everything that was talked about on stage, which is they're not going to stop with this one product. There's obviously latent demand. They're going to go out and build tons of different things. Build whatever the tokenized fund is called is one of them. He also talked about how, you know, ETH ETF is something that's on the horizon and doesn't expect. It's a if question. It's more of a question of when. And obviously there, and just yesterday I saw Fidelity file their S1 for ETH spot ETF with staking. So, you know, everybody's coming out, a lot of positive momentum.
Also, I love the conspiracy theories on, you know, why people are including staking in their ETFs. Like you can always, if you look hard enough, see like sinister signs and patterns and conspiracies of like, you know, they're doing this to get, you know, engagement and blah, blah, blah. Maybe they just want staking in the ETF. Have we considered that? So like,
stop, dude. That's way too reasonable. That's way too rational.
Hold up. I mean, yeah, I feel like we've beaten this horse to death, but my conviction on the ETH ETF is that nobody knows anything. And the fact that like people assume that the issuers would give material non-public information to people at Bloomberg is just like categorically insane. So look, like I think the odds on the ETH ETF are way too low on like places like Polymarket. It's also not, you know, 95%, but I think the market is going to kind of look at this as, I can't say what I was going to say because our compliance officer would shoot me. Anyways, I thought the conference was amazing. We also just like, you know, Michael and I, and you as well, Mike, just like hanging out, having beers with people, talking crypto, like that doesn't really feel like work to me. And LPs were, you know, excited. It feels like that has kind of returned. There was a while where that was like, you know, ice age frozen. Feels like that is beginning to thaw. And, you know, maybe this dovetails into kind of like the private market stuff, but like there is like a supply chain of capital where, you know, you have the endowments and the fund of funds that reload. Then the venture managers reload from that reload. And then you have the private companies raise money from the venture managers. And so like the beginning of the supply chain of capital is starting to thaw. And just from like what we've heard, like it seems like there's some funds that are like finishing pretty strong in terms of raising. I think some are struggling. But, you know, if people are, I've already seen people calling the top on this cycle. You know, find God, first of all. I think the other thing is like, look, like until you see the venture funds reload, like the private markets and the public markets aren't going to stop getting crazy.
To just to like hammer Vance's point, the money that's being invested right now, by and large, is money that was raised in 2022 or late 2021. And most of that has been held on through the last year and a half, 2 years, and it's been drip fed out from venture funds who knew that it would be a multi-year process to be able to get back into a mode that we're in right now, where LPs are at you know, unthawing. And so think about, you know, what happens here in terms of, you know, flows, let's just say. The Bitcoin ETF, okay, that brings in a net new buyer of $45 trillion of asset value that's locked up in RIAs and IRAs and, you know, all the people that couldn't really access Bitcoin previously. That's an unlock, and that's what the latent demand and the ETF launch showcases. The continued productization of all of that, I think, is going to expand just past Bitcoin into many other things, tokenized funds, you know, ostensibly Ethereum at some point here. But what always happens is you kind of trickle down. It goes like Bitcoin, alts, long tail assets, venture scale assets. And the people that are investing in each one of these stages is fundamentally different. The other thing is that the people that in this cycle are investing in each one of these stages is also fundamentally different. When people in previous cycles were buying Bitcoin and then rotating into, let's say, ETH, and then rotating into like DeFi assets, what they were implicitly doing in each one of those phases was they were selling the original purchase and they were set buying, you know, the next phase of this you know, chain. I don't see that same thing happening this time because the net new buyers that are coming in and building up the base in these assets, particularly Bitcoin right now, eventually in other assets, are people who are going to hold on to this because they're, you know, trapped in an ETF and they're net new buyers, they're asset allocators. They're not trying to buy Bitcoin, ride at 50%, sell, buy ETH, ride at 50%, sell, buy DeFi, ride at 10x. And so I think that the market structure of this cycle is going to be fundamentally different and possibly lends credence to an idea that we actually might not see the same four-year cycle again. And I know that that's like kind of a meme at this point, but I can actually see that just based off the way that the market structure is running right now, given the fact that we don't see billions of dollars of fresh new venture capital coming in yet. It will happen. Over the next 24 months, let's say 18 to 24 months, there will be billions of dollars raised. But right now, it's not available. It's not there yet. And as soon as that starts to happen, that's the start of the process of when these long tail assets would be able to get kind of bid up and get attractive. And so I think the people that are talking about, oh, is it going to be 12 months? Is it going to be 18 months from now when we see the top of the market? They're far underestimating what we have now with the new market structure.
I would guess that there's going to be 10 billion of venture funds that are raised in the next year. Like it's like we're talking about real money, and that's going to be like everyone's working off the tail end of their 2021 fund or 2022 fund, to Michael's point. Yeah. Like it's kind of like you're parceling out like the last of the fund, and then you're like starting to raise and all that's happening. Imagine when everyone has, you know, fresh capital. People forget that OpenSea got done at $13.3 billion. You know, Starkware was done at $10 billion FDV in the private rounds. Like, it's going to get pretty nutty.
One thing that I would also add, I was just looking for some of that for a chart of the amount of crypto VC that got invested over the last cycle. But one thing to support what both of you guys are saying, you know, we've talked about it on the show a couple times before now, but the beginning of this cycle already feels a little atypical compared to previous cycles. Like there are some data points that kind of match up, but there are some data points that aren't really matching up. Like I think you guys are absolutely right. Like, you know, Vance, to your point about the beginning of the capital supply chain thawing, it clearly beginning to thaw, but it's not like there are massive, and you guys tell me, like massive new VC funds being raised and there's money that's getting poured into crypto today. Like that's definitely not happening. Like there's some retail activity that's coming back, but it doesn't, you know, that someone at the conference referred to it as I guess David Mercer of LMAX referred to it as like a cab driver index. It's like, I'm not like taking Ubers and getting asked about like crypto stuff like I was in 2021. So I don't know. There are like,
maybe with meme coins though.
yeah, maybe.
But to your point, Mike, I mean, look, I think 1KX announced their $75 million fund earlier today. You've got, you know, $100-200 million funds that are coming back to market. So this is the start of the process of the unthawing, where you start to see a little trickle of interest, but it's in the, you know, 75 to a couple hundred million. You don't see the like Andreessen $4.5 billion or however big their fund was, you know, fundraises yet, you know, but I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see that stuff in, you know, the next 6 to 12 months. That process is getting started right now. But I think the bigger point is historically, you know, the net new buyers of Bitcoin were people who own Bitcoin. And when you own Bitcoin and see it rocket up and then you see new attractive opportunities, what are you gonna do? Are you gonna like somehow find some couch cushion cash and just put that into Ethereum, put that into DeFi? No, you're gonna take your core crypto asset, Bitcoin, sell that to buy something else. And the net new buyer isn't going to be selling on a 15% price move up or a 50% price move up. They're asset allocators. and they're going to take 1% and maybe it gets to 2% and then they start to rebalance. But like, that's how this industry is going to go forward. Not to mention every 2 weeks when people get a paycheck, they're going to start allocating more and more because, you know, their net asset base just went up by whatever, $10,000. And so, you know, small, but like every 2 weeks, it's another $100 for that $10,000, you know, allocation to their 401k. That adds up. And so what I'm kind of proposing is that there's a new market structure where the net buyer is not going to be a net seller as we move from one phase to the next. And we haven't even started to touch, you know, the net new buyers coming back in size with new funds, new capital. And so right now it's sort of dormant, but you can start to see the trickle before we get to the flood.
Yeah, I just think that's, I think you're right. I think it's tough to make this sort of call about breaking the four-year cycle. You know, Suzu famously made it last cycle and wasn't necessarily correct, but I think you'd be silly to ignore this massive catalyst, and the Bitcoin ETFs kind of do change a lot of things. And I know you guys have compliance. I've got no compliance. I feel like it's very, you know, you'd have to be pretty silly to bet against an ETH ETF. And eventually, maybe like somewhere years down the line, other ETFs of like, you know, Solana or TIA or whatever, after they get big enough and you build a futures market or whatever. So yeah, I do, and you know, to Matt's, one of Matt's key points is that when he was talking at Bass is that we haven't even seen the RIA sort of passive money come in yet, right? So yeah, there were a number of speakers that sort of estimated, it's like we've seen 20%, whatever. We're in like the beginning days of that insurge of capital.
We've heard that too about the wirehouses, where it's like even BlackRock is like, this is what we've heard, so take it for what it's worth. They're only like offering it to like 20% of clients, like the most sophisticated, the most, you know, maybe with the largest balance, whatever. But yeah, you're right. Like the tidal wave of money that's coming into the space, I do think, you know, lends credence to the idea that like the super cycle theory was ultimately correct. It's just like, can you stay solvent long enough for it to play out? And I think with assets like crypto, this is how I think about it, at least. You're either underexposed or you're overexposed. There is no real proper exposure. And, you know, like you think about our fund, compared to like any other vehicle on the planet, we are overexposed. But, and then you think about basically all of the RIAs that are like, you know, yeah, we're thinking about it. You know, we're 0% right now, but maybe we're like 1-3% in the future. Like they're drastically underexposed. And so I do think the super cycle theory is ultimately correct. Like, but, you know, can you stay in the game long enough for it to matter is kind of the real question. So yeah, don't blow yourself up if you're listening to this.
Can I ask maybe a pretty basic question? But you were mentioning that a lot of the capital that VC is deploying is raised in 21, 22. How long as a venture fund can you hold on to capital and not deploy it?
Forever.
Well,
really?
It depends on your LPA. But yeah, typically, you're going to have a minimum of a very minimum of 2 years for an investment period. But that investment period very easily can be extended to 5. And it's not even like has to approve it. Like typically it's like, hey, we can have from 2 to 5 years. If we need to go to 7 years to continue to deploy, we can go there. And in a typical venture structure, you're raising money, it goes in, you're calling it over time as you make investments. And then you're raising your next fund at the point in time when you launch that next fund, the investment period from a previous fund ends and you switch over to the new fund. And so it can be, you know, a period-based investment period, or it can be a successor fund-based investment period, where as soon as you raise that successor fund, you switch over.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I would like, something that I heard at the conference as well that kind of resonated just talking to some of the more institutional people that I've spoken to over the years, is like there's a little bit of a supply-demand imbalance between, like, especially like U.S. venture, like, whenever you talk to institutional investors, they're like, okay, like I'm either going to buy like some Bitcoin or ETH, or the other way that I can get exposure to the space is through this wrapper that I'm super familiar with, or vehicle that I'm super familiar with, which is VC. And they're saying that there's like almost like there could be considered like an oversupply of like, especially like US based VC compared to like liquid market, more hedge fund type opportunities. But the other thing it sort of feels like anecdotally is that a lot of maybe some of the like VC firms right now are rushing to deploy so that they can raise their next fund. Is that not the case?
No, I'm laughing. I'm shaking my head in agreement because with the recognition of not the best fundamental management of a fund if you're in that position, where the last 8 months you realize that the market is moving in a single direction and you're playing catch up. It means valuations are going to get blown out of the water. Deployment pace is going to be obscene. Diligence is going to go down. It's the same type of stuff we saw in 2021, writ large, where you just had to put capital in and it was rated deployment, not success of the deployed dollars. I think there's a lot of kind of misalignment in terms of certain funds, and you can get on the game of like, hey, we want to raise more funds so we get more management fees and then we get paid more and we continue on and have this job and hopefully one day the stuff that we invest in comes back, but like we don't really care because we're getting paid along the way. The other thing too that I think is interesting, and if you're being intellectually honest with yourself as a fund manager in the space, and to your point, Mike, venture funds have the ability, and venture funds, but funds in the crypto venture space should have, I believe, should have the ability to buy liquid assets because, there are points in time where you can justify a venture scale outcome from buying something, on a secondary market or directly from the team. The other thing that I think has to happen to be intellectually honest with yourself as a fund manager is you have to benchmark yourself against some index of performance of the rest of the market. One of the things that we think about is what is your index, what is your benchmark against a 50-50 Bitcoin Ethereum portfolio over the duration of your fund? And I've seen people like Nick from One Confirmation talk about this, but that is also, I think, a differentiating factor. If you're a fund manager charging, let's say, 2% and 20%, why is it that people should put money with you versus just buy Bitcoin and ETH and hold for the duration of the fund? There's rebalancing, there's sort of asset allocation, but you should be able to get alpha by putting into a higher cost fund structure like a venture fund. And that, I think, may become a narrative as well that separates the wheat from the chaff in terms of venture managers is, can you beat Bitcoin, basically?
50-50 ETH Bitcoin after fees. If you don't beat that, I don't think you should really be doing it as a living. The other interesting thing, I don't know if people will care about this, but I forget what the exact regulation is called, but most VC firms in the US, I think it's if they hold more than 20% liquid, they then have to, so there's this VC exemption in the US where if you hold less than 20% liquid assets, you don't have to register with the SEC and you don't have to report, or what is it?
It's slightly different. It's if you are not buying corporate equity, and that asset that you're buying is a digital asset or potentially secondary equity, that you're buying from somebody else, and that gets to be over 20% of the net asset base of your fund, you cannot use the venture capital exemption. The other thing is I can't remember if it's and or, but there's also a limit in terms of AUM. So if you aren't doing the 20% exemption and you are buying digital assets, but you're staying underneath $150 million AUM total across the firm, you don't have to register. Registering is a pretty big process. And that, I think, is something that not many people talk about, but you have to register with the SEC, you get examined, you get audited, there's new reporting guidelines, there's new cybersecurity guidelines, there's new audit guidelines. Like it comes basically with you basically turn into like a pseudo publicly traded entity or publicly regulated entity, and that I think is a big deal as well, which precludes a lot of traditional venture funds firms from moving in that direction because they've been able to be a venture capital firm that hasn't had to have the same stipulations and requirements because they've been under the 20% threshold. Not to pick on any specific one, but like the Kleiner Perkins of the world have historically just bought equity. They've never kind of come up to that 20% threshold, and they don't do a bunch of big deals where potentially buying secondary is their strategy. Whereas someone like maybe a Thrive who is or like a general catalyst who is doing, you know, secondary offerings where they're buying out, you know, major shareholders or potentially buying selling companies completely, you know, that would also trigger potential SEC registration. So
they're not buying crypto assets just because they don't want to register is the point. And so what's starting to happen in the US is like all these traditional venture firms are like kind of on this other path where they're just doing equity. They don't really have any liquid exposure. There's no IPOs. There's no M&A because of the FTC and LenaCon blocking it. And it's like looking pretty bleak. And then you look at the other side of crypto of like, you know, if you have some liquid exposure and, you know, a lot of these funds have done really, really well. And I was talking to, we can't name any names, but like this large outsourced CIO for a lot of endowments and pension funds. And I was like, would you rather invest in the median crypto fund or the median traditional venture fund? He's like, no question, median crypto fund. Better performance, better liquidity, better time to distributions. And so the theory of, I mean, one of the reasons we started Framework and we focused on crypto, other than loving crypto, was like, this is probably the only asset class that's moving fast enough that we can like leapfrog the traditional venture firms if we get lucky and we do our jobs well. And I think we're at the beginning of that starting to play out. I think the other part is like a lot of the traditional venture firms are going through generational change of the guard, you know, like the Michael Moritzes of the world retiring, you know, the Alfred Lins of the world, you know, dialing things back, like the next generation of people stepping up. And then you just got these savages, crypto fund managers that are like young, really hungry, pretty good performance. I feel like, you know, it's going to be an interesting few years just to see the whole capital landscape evolve. And it ties into the supply chain of capital thing that we were talking about where, you know, we're trying to basically talk to LPs about like, look, should we be in the crypto bucket or should we be in the general bucket? Like, does it matter? How do you distinguish? Like, what are the things that you think about? And we're getting a positive reception, which is cool.
I've like completely agree with that. Just from an outsider's perspective, it feels like like the infrastructure that you need to set up to trade liquids, like the ability to, or not trade, like invest in more liquid opportunities. And I don't know, just the willingness to do that and like to kind of go out on what would be perceived as the risk curve is going to be a massive advantage for funds like Framework moving into the future.
Imagine it too for this. Like people are like, why would we pay you to hold Bitcoin, ETH, you know, like all the majors, some alts, whatever. How bullish were you at $1,000 ETH? Were you willing to risk your career at your like, you know, outsource fund to fund to like, you know, bid some ETH? And would you do it in size? And would you hold it? Come on. Let's be serious.
The other point is, imagine you've been doing, you know, venture investing, signing documents and you know, equity agreements, share agreements, safe notes, preferred rounds, et cetera, et cetera. It's all document based and it stays with lawyers. And then you've been doing that for 10, 20 years and someone hands you a ledger and they're like, okay, here's your investment. And you're just like, wait, what? What are you talking about? Like there is a total different mindset that you have to be in. It's like oil and water. You cannot mix the two. This also cannot be, and that we have yet to see it done properly. And I know people point to Andreessen. I think it's actually furthering my point, but you cannot do this as a coverage area within an existing firm. It has to be a separate firm and it has to operate as such. And I think people, you know, over this cycle have completely realized that and, you know, they're either doing it or they're not, but, you know, Andreessen recognizes this as well because they spun the crypto, basically arm into its self-sustaining own unit. And it's still under the Andreessen umbrella, but it is completely, you know, autonomous in that respect.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to the title sponsor of this season of Bell Curve, the Wormhole Foundation. Now, if you are an on-chain user, which I bet you are, if you're listening to Bell Curve, you know that the cross-chain experience in crypto still sucks. Let's just call a spade, we talk about it on this program all the time. Interop is still a big problem, which is why we specifically wanted to team up with the Wormhole Foundation. They are a decentralized interop platform that powers multi-chain applications and bridges. So that could be anything from DeFi to NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. So if you are a developer and you're building cross-chain assets, apps, or data or anything like that, I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of this episode and go check out to see what you can build on Wormhole. And Wormhole, first of all, this is a fun team. They did something really cool with us. You can actually go and click the link at the bottom of the screen, which is going to send you to a landing page where you can claim your own unique Wormhole NFT. So we're doing this with me and we're doing this with Jason, my co-founder. So help a brother out. It's a super cool NFT, I promise. Go click the link at the bottom of this episode and fill out your POAP, get your free NFT. And if you're a dev, head over to Wormhole and check out to see what cool cross-chain stuff you can build. Hey everyone, Mike here. Wanted to give a quick shout out to Swell. We have been talking a ton on Bellcurve recently about the liquid restaking ecosystem in Ethereum and how it's been heating up. Really, really exciting stuff going on there. And Swell is leading the way with their very own first of a kind restaked rollup. If you're a nerd like me and you're curious what that actually means and how it's built using the Polygon ZK EVM. They're going full modular and relying on INDA in collaboration with AltLayer. The other thing that they're doing that's pretty cool is they're using the restaking mechanism from EigenLayer to get increased security and faster finality. So very cool construction. And then the benefit, if you either just want to use the L2 or if you're an enjoyer of RSweef, which is the liquid restake token, you can just do stuff on L2 and you can get that native yield. Obviously, whenever it comes to something like restaking or liquid restaking, there are risks, do your own research, etc. But Swell's a great team. They're going to be launching in the second half of this year, but pre-deposits are open now. So you can click the link at the bottom of this episode and tell them that I sent you. Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Flood Protocol, the optimal DEX aggregator. Now, Flood is the perfect partner for this episode on the multi-chain future because Flood is solving so many of the issues that we're going to be talking about this season. And this is relevant for both traders and devs. So if you are a trader, you should definitely head over to FloodSwap and start trading because they solve three massive problems. One, gasless trading. No more pesky trading fees. Two, you don't have to worry about getting front run. MEV free. And then three, they have excellent order routing so that you know that you are getting the best price. So head over to FloodSwap and click the link in the bottom of the show notes. We're going to send you right there. For the devs out there, you can leverage Flood's flexible hooks, allowing you to make swapping a first-class primitive by adding custom order types like TWAPs. Or if you're a wallet builder or something like that, you can actually build your own order flow auction in and start recapturing a bunch of that MEV. If you want to reach out to them, go to devs@flood.bid or just jump right in the Discord. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Appreciate you, Flood.
I've got a question for you guys, changing tack a little bit here about the almost the psychological impact of getting a liquidity event, especially for founders much earlier in the life cycle of a company. There are some real pros and cons that I've thought through this a lot. And I think one of the big downsides of equity is like traditional sort of equity or, you know, private equity at a company like Blockworth stage, for example, is the cons are obviously it's illiquid. You don't really have a great sense of when you're going to have that sort of liquidity event. And you know, especially when you're issuing equity to like employees and stuff, it's so complicated. Like who understands an option, right? Especially if this is your first startup, it's just very difficult to explain. And so, you know, not a lot of value ends up getting assigned to it. But, you know, the pro of that though, is that it's this very like motivating, unifying sort of force. There are all these, you know, in different functions of a company, sometimes you have people's incentives sort of bump up against each other. Like at Blockworks, sometimes editorial and marketing have like sort of clashed heads because the editorial just wants to like report, you know, very, very accurate. And the marketing's like, guys, we got to sell the sizzle here. You know, like, let's come up with some good headlines that people want to read. And so the way that the reason equity is so nice is that it aligns the incentives of like people that have, internal KPIs that bump up against each other. But the token, just to give the other side of that, is like, you get it liquid so early that people assign more value to it. I think you could argue that actually all else being equal, maybe the token should be worth a little bit more. You get a liquidity premium. But I've also wondered for myself, like what it would have done to me like 3 years ago if Blockworks just had some crazy liquidity event and I just sold a bunch of shares for a bunch of money. Like I'd like to think that it wouldn't have impacted me, but man, I don't know.
A couple of thoughts on this. And this is like an active conversation that we have with founders and founding teams consistently. Because the biggest thing you have to handle as being an early stage employee or being a founder in one of these protocols that launches in the first few years of your tenure at that company, at that protocol, is your own psychology and your team's psychology. And just to, you know, level set, let's say you join an early stage protocol. It takes 1 to 3 years to actually build it to get to the point of like full launch. And, you know, it's something highly technical. It takes a long time. It takes investment. And you spent those 1 to 3 years developing and building. Typically what happens is everybody is locked up from that investment, from that launch, either an investor or an employee, for anywhere from 3 to 4 years post-launch. Historically, and you know, there is an entire period of time when the tech industry was much more like what we're talking about right now in the 90s. You had Amazon, and I'm probably going to butcher the exact dates, you know, started in 1995, go public in 1997 or 1998 at like a $300, $400 million valuation. That is what these protocols are doing basically right now. And I think, you know, if you were an early employee at Amazon, let's say you had 4 year vest and you were there from the start, guess what? You're fully vested basically by the time that the IPO happens. Whereas with tokens, you're actually locked up. Usually it's a 1 year cliff post launch, and then it's like 36 months each month for after that cliff. So I actually think, you know, token unlock schedules for founders and investors, team members and investors, are actually a little bit more restrictive than what you would see in sort of the heyday of the IPO craze. We just kind of like lost that period of time, particularly because of Sarbanes-Oxley, which required all of the companies that are going public to have this insane amount of audit and financial controls. And you now it costs apparently, you know, $10 million a year to go if you want to go public, just to be a publicly traded company based off of the compliance, audit, tax, finance team that you have to develop, but also the compliant, you know, the cost from outside counsel, accountants, et cetera. So that's why the burden of going public has been pushed further and further later and later, which leaves this area of technology that is, you know, fast-paced, highly entrepreneurial, but it is something that, you know, already happened in the 90s. And so we've seen this before, it's just coming back. But to your point, you know, like what happens if you get liquid? I think the hardest part is like you're sitting there with locked tokens and you're like watching, you know, the token price go up and down after it launches. Like you can't do that. Just like, you know, in the 90s when people used to talk about, you know, at Yahoo, where they'd have like stock tickers on their homepage of like where the Yahoo stock was trading. Like literally Jerry Yang came in and was like, if you have that on your homepage, like you're fired. Like, do not check it. Not on company time. It's not something that we care about. We're here for the long run. This is where great founders and great CEOs or leaders of companies and protocols need to be able to manage the psychology of the team. It's just something that's totally different.
You know what? As a funny counterpoint to that, that's the exact opposite of what happened at Enron, where the stock price was in the elevators and they encouraged everyone to look at it. Yeah. Oh, isn't there this, like, didn't this just happen recently? It happened in the dot-com bubble as well, but there was some Web2 sort of startup. The founder was encouraging employees to take out loans to exercise options. Yeah, Bolt. Brutal.
Just brutal. I mean, okay, A, don't do that. B,
yeah.
That was a private company, and they were helping people take out loans to pay, basically buy the shares. So once you leave a company, typically you have 90 days to buy your options before, you know, they expire. And you know, it's a lot of cash that you have to outlay. It's also a tax burden when you buy them because it has minimum tax requirements. Don't do that if your stock isn't publicly traded. Also, if you're a founder, like one of the things that we push as well, and this is kind of the standard now for Y Combinator, for instance, if you're a founder and someone's been there for at least 2 years or 3 years, you extend that 90 days to something like 5 or 7 years.
Yeah, I mean, just as a global point, not even specifically related to like founders and tokens, it's always tempting to focus on, you know, how rich you are or how rich you could be, or, you know, like I also find it funny that there's like a desire from especially like crypto founders and tech founders to like become paper millionaires or a paper 100 or a deca millionaire. Like it just like doesn't make a ton of sense. And I think we've kind of like long since decided to like not really babysit our crypto and not like be checking the 1 minute candles. Because it's just cancerous to you. It's cancerous to your team. It's cancerous to the mission you're trying to execute. And I do like Chris Bernieske's analogy of it's like soap. You know, the more you touch it, the more you think about it, it's like the less you have. Literally the best investment strategy with crypto has been going into a coma for a decade. And, you know, it's different when you're running a company. There's more agency, there's more things to do. But to Michael's point, congrats, your token launched at 5 billion FTV and you own 5%. You're now worth 250 million. That versus waiting out the vesting schedule and selling it and like making the company successful are all very different things.
Totally agree with all that. One additional point, which I think is really important. We're talking about people who are there pre-launch into post-launch. One of the major benefits of having that launch is using it as a recruiting tool. And what I mean by this is anyone who joins afterwards, obviously they're going to get some allocation of tokens. They don't have to wait for like, you know, if you join at Series B, you're waiting for Series C to mark up your stock options or Series D to mark up your stock options, hoping there's an IPO one day. When you're joining at a post-launch early stage protocol, you're getting an allocation of tokens. So with the same 4-year vest or maybe even longer, you have to wait a year before you get anything, but you're aligned. And, you know, hopefully the value that you're providing to that protocol is directly translatable into the value of your assets. And that, I think, is a huge recruiting tool. And not to mention, like, there are paper millionaires. Like, people used to talk, like, I grew up in Palo Alto. People would talk about, like, all the millionaires that were printed from the Yahoo IPO or the Google IPO or the Facebook IPO. That was more billionaires. But yeah, there is an element in that becoming a recruiting tool because it builds the halo effect of those companies, of those protocols, and it draws people in.
So, okay. So maybe compounding on that question a little bit, how... I don't know. One thing that I have sort of started to know, there are a bunch of companies, protocols right now that I think have tried to be like the first to launch and get their token out there in a big category. So like EtherFi could be an example of this, right? Like LRTs, like EtherFi right now is trading at some crazy, like, I don't know anything about, I haven't looked into any of the metrics. Like, I think it's like $7 billion FDV, which I'm just going to go ahead and assume that's pretty rich, you know, but the reason why that might sort of rationally make sense is, everyone in the market knows LRTs are going to be a big thing. All the other stuff is private. You have to, you know, you're weighing the sort of illiquidity of that versus the crazy valuation. You're thinking like, maybe this can just run. So there's some amount of like sense that that makes there. And maybe there's an advantage to being first to market because you want to be that canonical token that people just buy. Like this could be the equivalent of Tau for AI crypto, you know, stuff. It's just like, yep, I could either like invest in this private AI thing that's, to be honest, really rich anyway, or I could just buy what I think is going to be the liquid instrument that people use to speculate on the AI crypto intersection. I feel like there's a lot, I can see a couple protocols that it feels like they're taking that strategy, but the downside to that, like I would be curious how you guys would advise a founder, because the downside to that, the upside to that strategy is like, hey, we're live, we have this crazy valuation. We can use that as a way to acquire new talent or I don't know, maybe companies, although even though I'm not a huge fan of M&A and crypto in general, but like-
Did see one of those this week.
Yeah. Or I missed that actually. What happened?
Please no more. No more M&A. Michael and I dabbled in token M&A last cycle, and I don't think it's an advisable strategy. Let's just put it that way.
What was the one that happened this week?
There's a combination. Sorry to totally derail. There's a combination of a couple of protocols who each have their own token into one token.
I guess I missed it, but this is like the Ferrari type, ill-fated, I'm not really sure what you're buying when you do that, but
you're not buying anything. Cause like, I mean, at least the Ferrari made a little bit more sense than like these three AI tokens just combining into one.
Oh, that's what it was.
There was two others.
But Mike, sorry, apologies for derailing, but to your point, I think, you know, there is an element what I think you're getting out of like what happens when, you know, the show potentially stops and it, you know, goes from being a recruiting tool to like a negative compounding cycle. And like, you know, I was at Snapchat during the IPO. You know, the stock popped and it stayed there for a little bit, but then it went down and it stayed down for a while. And, you know, same thing happens with companies as in like, think about Facebook as well. I don't know if you remember this. It's $100 billion IPO went up and then crashed. And it was trading below the IPO price for almost an entire year. And that, I think, you know, drove a lot of like questions as to what the future was. And this is pre them coming out with mobile advertising. They, at that point, still had basically like a web app for their mobile application, if you remember that. And the whole point that I'm trying to make is, if you don't have something, you know, post-launch that leads you to continue to bolster that growth, it can turn into a negative cycle. And this is where it needs to be something that you figure out very strategically how you launch, because a bad launch and something that doesn't fast follow and, you know, growth doesn't follow that launch can lead to pop and then a drop and a negative feedback cycle. Happens in companies just as it does better goals.
Yeah. Kind of like one of the cool things about crypto is that you get to play with incentives a little bit more. Incentives are really powerful when you harness them in the right way. But also it's just embracing, maybe incentives are the wrong word, embracing reflexivity to an extreme degree can just feel so good on the way up. But man, it feels really bad on the way down.
Remember also how we felt, you know, even a year ago?
Yeah.
So, yeah, dude. So my contrarian, maybe not super contrarian take is it's actually a really good process, because the people who get washed out during that negative feedback cycle probably weren't going to be there, or they had been there for a really long time. Like, you know, they're going to sell and move on and like go find something else to spend their time doing. That is actually probably a good thing. And I'm thinking more about like the people that left Snap, you know, the year after the IPO, or the people who left, you know, Facebook the year after the IPO. Like all of that stuff, I think, is a good washing and cleansing of the herd. And then they find a new vector of growth and like continue, you know, on a trajectory upwards. But it is actually sometimes a good thing to cleanse.
I heard a podcast a couple of years ago. I heard Hasu make that point, that exact point that you just made. And I didn't buy it at the time. And because at the time I was listening to this podcast, I mean, one of the things that used to give Yano and I a bunch of heartburn was like, we looked around, we have a rough understanding of like our competitors' revenue and like where we sit relative to them. And there was a point where we were like, we knew we had the same or better revenue than some of our competitors. They had five times the headcount of us. And we were just like, what the hell are we missing? Like, this is so, like, it was really psychologically damaging at the time. But then it turned out like we weren't missing anything. They were doing some not great or not very smart things. And then it did end up working out. Just like, it took like years to play along. So I don't know, if there are founders out there that are listening to this and you are maybe looking, you feel like you're making smart, disciplined decisions and you're looking at your competitors that aren't, and you're wondering if you're losing, just keep doing what you're doing. And just trust that sometimes it can take years to play out. But like, you guys, I'm sure, have seen it on the investment side as well. Like, there were some investors last cycle who looked like they were probably winning for a while, who weren't, you know, the most upstanding guys and gals of all time, and they're not here anymore. So
some of them are about to get sentenced to almost 40 years in prison.
Yeah.
I also think, just to be honest, it doesn't always play out like, you know, you win and they lose. Sometimes you both win, sometimes you know, like whatever, but there's always going to be people who make money that you don't like, or you don't think, you know, deserve it. I would encourage you not to focus on those people, because it's no tragedy that someone is making more than you. And it's kind of the same psychology of like, is the job as an investor or someone who's just managing their own capital to make good decisions and, you know, make returns that would put TradFi to shame? Or is the job rotating into the daily performing best coin every day for 5 years? It's not the second part. And someone's always going to have a better day than you, maybe better week and better year. You just have to bet over the long term that you're going to be okay.
Wise. Can we, I want to talk a little bit about Base. Actually, I saw this tweet from Ryan Watkins, and just here, I'm going to show some of the stats from Base recently. But we talked about it a good amount on the show already. But Base is this really interesting L2 because they've obviously got, you know, Coinbase, the relationship with Coinbase, and you look at just the revenue chart here, it's pretty impressive. And yeah, you can see they're doing like $2 million a day. If you're an annualizer at home, right, you might be backing into some pretty spectacular revenue predictions for the year. But, you know, already you're moving into some, I mean, this is pretty real revenue. I feel like there's actual real adoption going on over in Baseland. This is probably meme coin adoption. So we can have a debate about whether or not that's real. All of this volume is coming from UniV2. I'd probably count it as real. I mean, I don't know. I feel like Base could really be one of those. Everyone is already interested in it as an industry, but we might even just be sleeping on how many newcomers, you know, they go to Base for the first time. I think Coinbase has a real opportunity here to lean in and make the onboarding process extremely, very differentiated, very smooth onboarding process from the app onto the chain. So
cool. The cool thing too, I found is, I mean, first of all, this is like a classic example of like a background narrative that's just been lurking and waiting to take center stage. And like, I think we're going to see more, not less of that. And the other cool thing is like, now that Base has, you know, so many users, they're starting to push for things like raising the gas limit, which then pushes ETH-L1 to like also raise the gas, or like, you know, it's like they've become kind of one of the driving forces of Ethereum development, which is really, really cool. I think like prognosis for the future of ETH is like all the L2s are like, you know, community citizens, all the apps are also community citizens. Like, it's cool to see these things driving adoption and then driving changes as a result, which push the industry forward. So it's cool to see. And their smart wallet is really cool also.
Dude, the smart wallet is so cool. It's phenomenal. I did a, when at ETH Denver, actually, I did a fireside with Will Robinson, who's the head of engineering and product at Coinbase, who is extremely based himself. But yeah, it's a very cool, like, I do feel like some of the stuff that has been holding crypto back for such a long period of time. I was having a debate with a buddy of mine this week about why, I don't know, it was on the whole subject of like meme coins. Are they good? Are they bad? Because they suck a lot of like attention and energy and like are sort of discouraging from founders away from like actual legit projects. And I was sort of ascribing some of the reason why we haven't seen many apps that don't have traction because of that. And I just don't really agree with that, actually. I think the reason that we don't have apps is because, you know, up till this point, you haven't, if you're an app developer, you know, you have like, you had like kind of two options, even as of like 9 or 12 months ago. You could decide not to take platform risk and then launch on ETH main chain, which basically means that you have massive gas fees, right? And that's extremely prohibitive. Or you could decide to launch on like either Solana back then was really contrarian, or I guess you had the L2s as well, but you definitely were taking some element of platform risk. I think this is the first time now where there's plenty of, you know, really cheap, abundant block space on chains where it doesn't feel like you're taking any platform risk. So I feel like I keep willing this out there because I just want this to happen. But like, I hope that this might be the cycle where, you know, we shift a little bit of this infra investment, which has made massive strides. But I think it's ready now for some actual apps that can onboard millions of people. Like, I would hope that we see this cycle.
We've talked about this literally on the podcast coming up to Dancun 4844. Yeah. And I don't know exactly where, which day on the chart, but it's basically where that exponential growth happens in terms of revenue. Remember how we were talking about the fact that when you reduce something by 10x in terms of block space cost, there is a greater than 10x increase, which increases the total amount of revenue. This is that chart.
Yep.
You now have a new set of application categories that can exist in this ecosystem because the cost is less prohibitive. We're just going to continue to see this as we drop another 10x. It's going to go up way more than 10x in terms of transactions, which means new applications, which means new things, which means, and you know, to the meme coin point, like they're neither good nor bad. They just are. And that I think is, you know, it's sort of like financial gravity or like trying to divert a river as it's flowing. It's just going to happen and it's going to flow in different ways. And meme coins happen to be the thing that's happening right now. I don't think they're good or bad. I think they're hilarious. It's just kind of like, you know, they're cultural. And that is that in and of itself is a positive. Sure, maybe like some people think they take away from people doing serious things and building serious applications. I don't think they take away. I think they actually add to it. And that ultimately is a positive because it brings people into the industry.
I'm with you on that. And the reason I also don't think that it takes away from people doing positive things is like sometimes maybe it gives you a little bit of heartburn, you know, if you've been like slogging away at something for 6 years and you like see someone launch a meme coin and make like more money than you could like ever
possibly. That's the hedonic treadmill. That's what we were just talking
about. It is.
About.
I know.
You cannot pay attention to that.
You can't pay attention to that. And also when I really think about it, like I just wouldn't do that anyway. Like even though that is an option, even though that exists, like I just wouldn't, it's not my personality. I just couldn't make myself do it anyway. So it's a silly, I agree. I'm basically agreeing with you. I think it's not actually that much of a driving force there, and it doesn't really matter. And probably it's going to end up being a net positive to these ecosystems. Like these meme coins that are trading on Base now are going, like some amount of users are going to go up there to trade meme coins and they're going to stay. I don't know. Maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 5%, maybe it's 25%. I've got no idea, but it probably will end up being positive.
So I was thinking about the corollary to what meme coins are for, you know, the same corollary to what the internet had. And the best example that I can come up with is it's kind of like, do you remember the first video you saw on YouTube? I do.
I actually don't remember what I remember. The earliest one that I can think of is that guy in the woods who'd be like, give me some fried chicken. You know, he'd be like very,
mine was lightsaber guy.
Waffle fries.
The guy who, you know, set up the tripod at high school film production studio and like did the lightsaber and he like made his own sounds too. Yeah. It was hilarious. All that stuff back then, the cat videos, the lightsaber guy, that looked so like weird and fringe and stupid. But now, whenever I go to watch, you know, TV, it's YouTube TV. It is plugged into my computer. The application is on my, you know, TV at home. Like that maturation process, I think, is kind of the same thing that we're going to see. Maybe not main point specifically, but they start to look, they look like toys. They look like, you know, fringe. They look, you know, something that's not going to survive. But ultimately, certain things will. Certain things will die. But we're at that phase of development now from cultural and community-based into something that is fundamentally productive. And this is the reason why I think you can never discount this stuff, is because the community, number one, is a positive. It's net positive to the industry right now. But number two, ultimately, it could give life to something that is fundamentally differentiated over time, just like YouTube did.
Okay. I think that's a really good analogy. And who would have predicted back at that time? So obviously, a lot of these people that made these crazy viral fringe videos at the time like didn't amount to much, but like the next wave of people that come in saw the opportunity. And I don't know, like there's obviously Mr. Beast now that everyone knows, they're Logan and Jake Paul, you know, love them or hate them, but I don't know, have you guys heard much about Mr. Beast's candy and his like
that his burger company?
Yeah. So I guess Logan Paul has an energy drink which is doing like $400 million in sales or some insane number. Like, I don't know. It's real stuff. And if you had been predicting this, you know, imagine like we could be hosting this podcast at that time when we're watching these lightsaber deals. And like, imagine if you said that eventually this is going to lead to someone making $400 million. You'd be like, okay, dude, you know, sure. You've lost it.
You know, it's not going to be the Joe Bowden token itself, but it's going to be the concept of Joe Bowden that ultimately is successful.
You should always assume like the people who are doing these somewhat stupid things are smart. You should like steel man it from that perspective. You shouldn't assume that they're stupid and like work from there.
I agree.
You should try to like, you know, think about it critically.
I guess like one just closing story for you guys that I'd love to get your take on is I guess like last callback to DAS is I did a honestly I thought it was gonna be a pretty technical panel, but I actually ended up enjoying it a good amount with folks from Copper, DRW, I'm blanking out some of the other names, but it was on like collateral in crypto, and it was interesting to hear DRW's perspective on this. And it was this guy Paul dropped a pretty, I think, bullish statement for Steeth, which is like one of the things that they care a lot about is capital efficiency. So most of the liquidity right now for trading pairs is still in Bitcoin and ETH. But they don't want to just be holding Bitcoin and ETH and getting no yield. So they actually, like, a metric that's really critical and important for them is like they want to be holding Steeth. And then when they have to trade into ETH for the, you know, to trade into something else, they want to minimize the amount of time that they're actually holding ETH on their balance sheet, which I thought was super interesting. And then there's a new sort of, I don't know, like on-chain money market fund, like USYC, which is pretty interesting. That's like if you want to hold dollars, but you want to be getting some yield. And then BlackRock just launched this product as well, which I guess has seen some just around $250 million in terms of inflows. And I don't know. I think there's a Steeth implication here, which I find super interesting. But kind of just this like yield story. I think people really underestimate how much TradFi really loves yield and capital efficiency. And I think that's only going to become bigger and bigger moving forward from here.
So two things on that. I mean, the first one is like people like to talk about the ETH BTC ratio. I think it's frankly like so volatile that it's like not really worth thinking about too much. But you know, you've only underperformed Bitcoin if you've literally taken your ETH, not staked it, and put it in Coinbase. You know, the yield that we've earned over the past few years, like that basically puts us up on BTC. And so like there is that yield manifesting in a way that comes back to performance. The other thing I'll say is the utility of Steeth, being able to borrow against it on chain, things like Maker, things like Aave, things like Morpho, like the only way that we could run the strategy that we run, which is a, you know, venture hybrid approach to both liquid and venture strategies, is using Steeth. There is no other asset that we could have be, you know, that big rock in our fund. Like Sol, like there's just not enough borrow on chain. Bitcoin, like we'd have to wrap it, rely on BitGo. There's not enough borrow on ETH for that either. Really the only way to kind of run this crypto native strategy that we have is with Steeth as like, frankly, like the big rock. And also like the capital coordination layer of Maker and Aave and you know, Morpho. But like the BlackRock stuff as well, the fact that they have $250 million in there right now and yields are so high, like, you know, you can put in Athena for 30%, you can put in the DSR Maker for 14-15%. Like these business models do have risk, but I think smart contract based lending is the best business model on the planet, because if the loan goes sour, there's no calling someone and trying to get the money back. It's just like, we've instantly liquidated the collateral. We've given, you know, the liquidation fees to the people who are backstopping it, and we're moving on. It is like the most safe and secure thing, like versus like private credit or CRE loans. I don't know. One sounds more risky, obviously the crypto side, but like, you know, I think about what to do with my cash. I'm like, do I want to put it in like a private credit fund that has like a 3-year lock and a who knows what they're investing in, backed by what collateral? And I guess they'll call me if something goes wrong. Like, fuck that.
Funniest line we had recently was someone who said, yeah, you know, those public funds, they've really been beating us up. But those private funds, they've been holding in there. It's like, huh, I wonder who's marking to market on a daily basis.
Yeah.
That's a hilarious statement. That's
yeah.
Super funny.
The other funny one that I heard, this is like kind of a different thing. But so there's you know, the theory of investing, which is like atoms and bits. And bits are like the digital side, you know, and that's like what we've been doing for the past, yeah, who knows, 20 years. Atoms are like the, we're going to go build like meat space, physical things. Like, you know, it's very in vogue right now, mostly because people have just gotten beat to shit on like traditional software deals for the past 3 years. It's like, you know, Anduril, and then there's like SpaceX, and then there's like all these like American dynamism defense companies. And I was talking to this LP, and he was like, yeah, you know, we've really pivoted from bits to atoms. You know, it's real. I think it's just going to be a lot, you know, easier, more productive, you know, more returns. It's like, so you're going to build like the most capital intensive companies known to man that have the lowest margins that you can dream of, and just hope that you get to like super scale versus like investing in software. But that's kind of like where the world is now, like from an institutional capital allocated perspective. They've just been burned on these deals.
You know what? That is the epitome of
pivoting into something more dangerous.
I know.
That's the epitome of selling the bottom and moving into something else because you're pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I think I heard like Bill Gurley or one of these guys describe that like VC is kind of the VC came up at the same time as software. Like it only, like the model really works best with software companies. And like, if you've done well in other things, like it's sort of an anomaly. Like look at like WeWork and things like that, when they're just,
I mean, you can build business, like there's a lot of like direct to consumer type businesses that have been venture backed, like Peloton was venture backed, Fitbit was venture backed. Like you can have those types of like full product companies be venture scale outcomes, but that does not, you can't build a venture industry around that. No. You have to have, you know, 85% gross margin businesses, software businesses, be the basis of how the venture industry continues to grow.
Yeah. Well, one thing I think we actually had, honestly, of all people, SBF on a webinar like 2.5 years ago. And he said something about yield that like actually resonated with me. He was a smart, like it's unpopular to say, he did a lot of bad stuff. He's probably going to go to prison for a long time, but he wasn't an idiot. And he said this thing about yield, which like really sat with me. He was like, remember a while ago, people were like, where's all this yield coming from in 2021? And he said, basically, people think that the market is going to go up. And he's right about that. Like yield ultimately comes from growth, right? Like debt yield comes from, hey, I think I can, if you give me money now, I can turn that into more money later so that I can pay you off. So growth is the ultimate driver. And that creates like debt yield, all these different types of yield. And like, which is very, you disagree with that?
I think it's more than that. I think that's a major component. I do think that there's like a liquidity element. I mean, in the same way that you have a house and you need to be able to like take out you need to refinance your house, or you need to like take out collateralize your house to take out borrow money to be able to go off and like improve your house. Like having assets gives you the option of getting liquidity as well. But generally, I think as we see market scale, like if you look at Maker right now and the breakdown of the collateral and sort of like where the revenue is coming from via the Maker protocol, it has shifted from real world assets into crypto collateral. I think that is a shift and a recognition of, I think these crypto assets are going to go up. I'm willing to pay the 15% stability fee to like try and beat the market. Essentially.
I think there, I was maybe oversimplifying quite a bit there, but there, what it does make sense to me based on, and certain assets in crypto, right? Like Bitcoin, ETH, et cetera, those are pretty large, like liquid assets. So it makes sense to me why there should be more like positive real yields in crypto, whereas mostly in like TradFi land, you're dealing with negative real yields for the most part. Cause like inflation's going to end up being a little bit stickier. Like growth is a little bit more lagging than everyone hopes it's going to be. I don't know. There's an interesting, the very first season of Bell Curve we ever did was on like fixed rate lending in DeFi and crypto, probably like way, way too early on that. You guys were the first guests ever on Bell Curve. Let's go, baby. And I don't know, at that time, I wonder if it'll be interesting to see many cycles, or I don't even know if we have cycles anymore, but it'll be interesting to see what the yield and sort of lending and interest rate dynamics are in crypto versus TradFi and how correlated those are over like a long period of time. Because at one point, remember, it's kind of the narrative was that, hey, there are lots of positive real yields in crypto. And then it was like, oh, actually, it's really cheap to borrow in crypto. We're going to import those yields from TradFi where they're super positive. And I could see this almost this being like constant sort of arbitrage or like dynamic in between these two, where it's either like cheaper borrow here, import real yields, or like actually get yields over here. And it kind of feels like crypto wins both ways in that.
Yeah. The tough part with the TradFi yields, though, is that it's kind of a question as to how do you get that? How do you get that borrow? Who's giving you that borrow? What are you collateralizing to get that borrow?
Yeah. You know what hasn't really happened yet that I'm a little bit surprised about? And this was what you guys said in that first episode. I think you were looking like you were dead right. Is like the CeFi infrastructure that like extended a bunch of the credit last cycle has not really been rebuilt.
No. I mean, we're starting to rebuild it, I think. Also, keep in mind, there was like a banking crisis somewhere in the middle of all of this. So, you know, we're like, people are still reeling from that and like all the bad CRE, like lending is kind of out of vogue in general right now. But I mean, it just makes like DeFi all the more powerful. Like the thing that we did really well was when DeFi yields were and borrowing rates were lower than TradFi yields and borrowing rates, like we took advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And that was at a time when also all the asset prices were much lower. And now it's kind of like, you know, the Fed funds rate is at like 5.5 and borrowing crypto is at like 13.5. So it's a lot different. But I think that's going to be the incentive to move into the space. Like the build fund that is just like acquiring more assets on chain, that's going to be one directional as long as these yields stay this high. And then people are going to notice it, and then people are going to start to lend more against it, because that's what Build is doing effectively is lending, even if they don't really realize it.
Agreed. All right, fellas, I think that's basically it. This was a fun one, guys. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Later, man.
Hey everyone, Mike here. If you're a Bell Curve listener, you know that transferring assets across chains can be a massive pain. I certainly do. I complain about it on this program all the time. That is why we're incredibly excited to have teamed up with the Wormhole Foundation, the stewards of the Wormhole protocol. And the coolest part about this particular partnership is that they have made custom Bell Curve NFTs, which you can get and mint for free. Click the link at the bottom of this episode. Take you get your free NFT.